But, again, if a person is not afraid, nothing bad can happen. If you are haunted or think you are possessed, then you just have to say very, very firmly an affirmation that nothing can harm you and that the entity persecuting you will dissipate. These entities don't want to dissipate, so they go away very quickly in search of someone else who cannot banish them, so there is nothing to be frightened about except of being afraid. My father is a teacher in a junior high school and has a growing interest in your teachings. He often tells me of destructive delinquency of the kids. They are supposed to be from good families. How can these kids get out of their ruts or be helped? I thought I had dealt with it at considerable and tedious length already, because I really firmly believe that there won't be any improvement in conditions until the mothers stay at home and make the home. Nowadays, children are left to wander in the streets where they fall prey to stronger companions who are most often bent on destruction, and so they contaminate the kids from good families. The only way the matter can be overcome is to revamp our society so that once again motherhood is a virtue instead of an unfortunate accident. Yesterday, a girl approached my wife and I and tried very hard to sell us her Buddhism. I told her I had another path and that her sales pitch turned me off. How is one to be sure of which path to follow? Oh, that's an easy one. The real Buddhists have no missionaries. The real Buddhists never try to persuade anyone at all to become a Buddhist. You have probably fallen foul of one of these awful cult girls who lounge about nowadays and try to get other victims who will pay dues to some imaginary Buddhist society. Let me say again that if anyone tried to get you to become a Buddhist, then he or she is not a Buddhist, because Buddhism is just a way of life and not a religion, and Buddhism has no missionaries. There are too many cults nowadays. There is a pseudo education in which young punks of both sexes think they are the chosen messiah who should get recruits for this, that or some other society. In connection with this, I am going to do what I rarely do. I am going to advise you to read a particular book all about secret societies, giving the origin of some of the cults who are always advertising in the papers nowadays, cults who try to get your money for their own ends. The book is Secret Societies, edited by Norman Mackenzie and published by Crescent Books of New York. In my opinion, this is a most excellent book and one that I thoroughly recommend. I wish I had written it myself. Wayne and I are vegans. We follow Professor Arnold Ehret's diet. It consists of fruit and vegetables, no animal products, and nuts. I often wondered what you might have to say about it. Is it a diet that leads to freedom from disease, as the professor believes? Also, I am anxious to have people such as yourself get complete nutrition from barley, tea and butter. What do you think of this diet? If I really told you what I thought, the publisher would probably fall off his chair in a dead faint, because my thoughts on such things are incendiary. I think these crackpot diets are bunk. I think they are real muck. The US military forces had a long trial of people taking the ordinary everyday military diet and those crackpots who went in for vegetarianism, you know, a cabbage leaf and a handful of nuts and things like that. Well, after 6 months, the American authorities discovered quite definitely that the vegetarians were inferior in everything, inferior in brain power, inferior in physique, inferior in endurance, and definitely no more healthy. On this earth we are animals, and as we are animals and behave like animals, we should eat that which our animal bodies demand. So if you take muck like this stupid diet and you find that your health is deteriorating, you have no one but yourself to blame. I have no sympathy whatever with all these crackpot, stupid diets which have never been proved to be anything but a cult. I have just bought the Tibetan Book of the Dead. Have you any comments? Oh, I get such a heap of people asking about the Tibetan Book of the Dead. But, quite truly, it is wholly unsuited for Western people, because it is a concept, an abstract concept, and one just cannot turn it into a concrete book of instructions. You see, Evans Wentz was a very good man indeed, but he was a strong Christian, and whatever he wrote was greatly colored by his instinctive aversion to those heathens who had beliefs so different from his own. So he always tipped the balance against the heathen. And, again, You cannot translate abstract terms into concrete phrases. That is why there is so much misconception about acupuncture and about much of the teachings relating to metaphysics. I believe that any person wanting to study the Book of the Dead should first learn Sanskrit. Anita Kellaway writes to say, could you tell us more about the aura and device that could be made to see one's aura? That is very interesting and could be so useful if some intelligent person would use it right. I don't understand why doctors aren't begging you to make one for them. Well, I have already written quite a lot about the aura, and an aura machine could be made if one had the money and the female models who would be willing to be studied. I have already said, though, that I can get neither. Some people now believe that the Curlian system is the answer. But I think I had better mention the Curlian system in another chapter, because to my definite knowledge the Curlian system of photography is just something going in the wrong direction. I know it to be an absolute waste of time. Chapter 8, in the days of long ago when the century was yet young, Kaiser Bill stamped along his corridors in the palace at Berlin thinking of world conquest, thinking of all the wonders he was going to perform. Trying to conceal his defective arm, he gesticulated enormously with the other in an attempt to compensate for his physical deficiencies and deformities. Kaiser Bill was getting ready to go to England to show off the might of the German Navy at a British naval review. In a dacha on the outskirts of Moscow, the Tsar of all the Russias twirled his well-waxed moustache and thought of all the wonders that were going to happen in Russia. About him the courtiers were servile, concealing from the great Tsar the truth of things as they were in Russia, concealing the truth about the growing unrest of the people, about the starvation of the peasants. The Tsar of all the Russias sent his servants scurrying about him, for he was going on a long journey all across Europe to England. In England preparations are being made for an enormous naval review at Spithead. Heads of state were coming to see the review, and all the might of the British Navy was going to be paraded before envious eyes. The streets of London were cobbled. Horses' hooves clattered enormously on the rough stone surface, and the iron-rimmed wheels of handsome cabs juddered as they crossed the uneven cobbles, jarring the passengers inside, who were suspended in their carriage only by the leather straps at each corner. The streets of London were lit largely by gas, that newfangled thing electricity was taking but slow hold on the great metropolis, and cars, well, cars were not yet to be seen except as a rarity of rarities, as a spectacle that would set everyone's head turning. The great London hospitals were thronged with eager, devoted young men anxious to make a name for themselves in the new fields of medicine. In one great London hospital an ardent young man, Dr. Kilner, studied and went in for research on that strangest of all things which newfangled electricity would make possible: X-rays. Late into the nights he labored trying different arrangements of voltages electricity provided by the immense Compton dynamos, which were then the most wonderful things to appear in the world of electrics, because the science of electronics was not yet born. Dr. Kilner studied all manner of strange methods of investigating the human body. He found that if he used immense voltages and extremely small amperages, he could project lights from the edges of the human body. He called it testing for the aura. And then he went further in his researches and found that certain arrangements of prisms and lenses aided by filters of special dyes would enable him to see the aura on a nude human body, but the body had to be nude. One day poor Dr. Kilner was caught examining a nude woman by the light of the special lamp. No matter that the intruding doctor could see colored lights in all manner of strange shades on the screen through which Dr. Kilner looked. His research was closed down, he was hauled before the Board of Governors and the Board of Medical Directors, and he was threatened the most solemnly that if he ever did research on the human body again, and in that particular field, he would be disbarred, crossed off the British Medical Association register, and who knows? With his career in shards around him, he might even end up as a labourer or as an occupant of the local workhouse. Dr. Kilner was given the option of getting out of the medical profession or obeying orders and doing research into the dosages of the newly discovered X-ray photographic treatment. So to mankind's lasting shame, one of the great discoverers was buried in obscurity. Dr. Kilner lapsed into mediocrity and did merely routine things in the world of X-ray. The science of aura research was lost. The Great War came, the First Great War. X-rays were used for the first time on wounded soldiers. Medical science advanced, but always in the wrong direction. The X-ray machine was not the answer. The war was won, but not by the winner. The loser, Germany, came out of it best of all. First of all, though, people trundled millions of marks along the streets of Germany. Millions of marks were needed to buy even a poor meal. The mark became devalued. There was much trouble in Germany. Russia, too, was in a state of chaos because a new party had risen, the Communist Party, the Soviet, and they were making wonderful strides in adapting the new knowledge of the West. In early 1960 and on to the 1970s, an author wrote certain things in books on metaphysics which stimulated the interest of the Russians, who were always alert for such things. Numbers of this author's books were taken to Russia and studied by avid investigators. Eventually, under state direction, certain researches were carried out in the universities of Moscow, studies which broke away from what really was the wrong type of research. X-ray was forgotten for a time in Russia, and investigators they used high voltages in an attempt to detect the magnetic field of the human body. In Russia there was no problem about nudity. The individual did not matter, everything was subservient to the needs of the state. In the course of time, so-called civilization went its devious way, and there was a man and woman, husband and wife, in Russia who worked together and managed to make a study of many systems which had been tried in the past. Eventually these people, the Kurlians, were able to devise a modern adaptation of an old system, and by this particular system they found that they were able to obtain certain phenomena on photographic film. Now, this does not mean that the Kurlians have succeeded in photographing the human aura. Definitely they have not, because basically their system is so crude that it can be likened to covering a horseshoe magnet with a piece of paper, and on top of the piece of paper sprinkling iron filings so that the lines of magnetic force would be indicated as the iron filings arrange themselves in a pattern dictated by the magnetic influence from the magnet. All the Kurlians have been able to do is to make more or less clear that there are certain lines of force about everything. But, once again, the Russians claim that the invention is theirs, although Nikola Tesla, who was born in 1856, made the apparatus which laid the foundation for Kurlian photography, and our Nikola wasn't a Russian either. Certain authors have been to Russia and have returned with wonderful tales of the progress which Russian metaphysicians have attained. Some of these authors have written books about the matter, lauding the Russians higher than the heavens and entirely oblivious of the fact that certain authors in the West had already written about such things and could do all that the Russians could do. One author in particular wrote to various lauding persons pointing out these facts, but without ever receiving even an acknowledgement. The author sent to some of these people copies of his own books which had been in print long before the Russians discovered all the marvels of which they wrote. Kurlian photography is a false lead, just as was X-ray to Dr. Kilner. Kurlian photography is merely a distorted form of corona discharge. It merely shows a certain static electric discharge, or shielding of a discharge, around the human body. One can have a horseshoe magnet, or even a bar magnet, and cover it with a piece of paper, and then if one sprinkles iron filings on the paper, one can get a form of one-dimensional impression of the magnetic field of the magnet, but that does not constitute exact knowledge of the magnet's performance nor of its composition. It is, in fact, just a parlor trick and nothing more. In such a manner the Kurlian system, which is merely a revival of something going back 50 or 60 years, is nothing but a parlor trick which is leading good sound investigators far off the proper track. Kurlian photography is amusing. It enables one to do parlor tricks with leaves, etc., and even in color, but then all corona discharges are in color, are they not? It is such a pity that people nowadays seem to think that anything exotic and exotic means only foreign must necessarily be good, better than the home product. There is an old saying which is very true to the effect that no man is a prophet in his own country. So it is that the Kirlians, who have merely resurrected an old system, are getting much attention which would not matter in the slightest except that it is sending reputable scientists off the right direction. The correct form of X-ray which will come in time will not be those miserable shadows that one sees on a piece of thick film. It will, instead, be an exact color reproduction of inside the human body, and if Dr. Kilner had not been sidetracked he would have produced such a form of photograph because he was on the right trail. He had the knowledge which he brought down from the astral, and toward the realization of which he was just fumbling. Correct X-ray it would have been called something different at that time, of course would have enabled doctors and surgeons to see precisely what was happening inside the body and exactly as it was happening and in its own natural color. Then there would have been no need for exploratory operations, one would have seen instead. And if those doctors had only listened to Dr. Kilner or a photography also would have been a commonplace, and with photography of the aura one can tell precisely what ailments a body suffers from, and, even more interesting, one can also tell with complete accuracy what ailments a body is likely to suffer from unless remedial steps were taken at an early stage. Aura photography is very real, it is very necessary to the human race. It was commonplace in the days of Atlantis, it was commonplace when the Sumerians were upon the earth, and yet through jealousy, through spite, and through spiritual blindness, researchers with the basic knowledge have been prevented from making such apparatus. One of the greatest stumbling blocks, it seems, is that a person must be nude to be examined at the aura level. And in hospitals now it is permissible to examine one small area of the human body while the rest is completely draped. It seems to be a crime of some sort to look upon a nude body unless they be on the beach or the stage or in the pages of some of the more pornographic magazines. But in time X-rays as we know them today will be swept away, gone into the limbo of forgotten things, gone, too, will be the latest gimmick, Kirlian photography. Which if it is ever mentioned as being in the past will be with a condescending smile at the credulity of the stupid people of the 70s who could be taken in by such a gimmick. Kirlian photography, then, is not the answer to aura photography, it is not aura photography at all. If you go by the side of a swift flowing river and you put your hand in the water you will find that there are ripples and disturbances of the smooth flow. Your hand has upset the even tenor of the water's flow and made itself manifest by ripples and a wake which spreads outwards. In the same way if one has a very high voltage and a very low amperage connected to certain metal plates and the electricity be switched on, then anything which impedes the flow of that electrostatic current will also show as ripples, or speckles, which are merely amusing to look at and have no worthwhile content at all. Well, I hope that will assist some of you to form your own opinion about Kirlian photography. I have been sickened by the whole affair because I think I must have had the world's largest collection of cuttings about Kirlian photography. People have cut out loads of articles and have sent them on to me. Some of these people, in fact, have such big parcels of cuttings and articles that they felt I should be honored to pay the postage. So they have sent off these things and I have had to pay double postage on things I knew all about. That reminds me that some time ago a man in St. Catharines, Ontario, I think he must have been mental or something, loaded up boxes with the most awful junk of magazines and paperbacks that he could lay his hands on, and he sent them all to me carriage forward. Well, in those days I was younger and more innocent than I am now, so I took in those things after paying a very considerable charge for special delivery, special handling, and all the rest of it, and I found that the stuff he had sent me unsolicited was muck. But he didn't get away with it, he made one little mistake in which I could see that he had been doing, of which his company would thoroughly disapprove, so I got in touch with the company and sent the evidence to them, and well, I had a letter of apology and of thanks from the company concerned, and I had no trouble whatever with that smart aleck who thought he was going to take a rise out of me. But in case anyone else is inclined to send me stuff, collect, save yourself the trouble, because I do not accept anything now, collect. I have had people try to telephone me from all over the USA who thought I was foolish enough to accept collect telephone calls or collect telegrams. Well, they had to think again. I have also stopped giving my telephone number to people because when I was in Vancouver I found I was getting extraordinarily high telephone bills and I just could not understand what I was being charged for calls to other cities for, and so the matter was investigated. It was found that a near neighbor who knew my telephone number had been giving it to the operator when he was making long distance calls. Nice fellow, eh? Well, he didn't get away with it either. But now here are some more questions and some more answers. A question here says, it's 5 years now since you wrote Beyond the Tenth, in which you said that it may be necessary for the gardeners of the earth to step in and shake things, humans, up so that we realize what a mess we have made of this planet. Well, things are steadily getting worse, as you said. Communism is spreading rapidly and unions are gaining what will amount to complete control of many countries fairly soon. In the light of this, can you tell us if we are going to get a well-deserved kick in the pants within the next 30 or 40 years? Yes, my friend, but first of all, the gardeners of the earth do not want to interfere if humans will pick themselves up and put themselves on the right path. Because if the gardeners of the earth have to come in, then there will be drastic measures taken, and they don't want that any more than we want it. In my opinion, the world will become communist just about everywhere, and people will have a very bad time indeed, and not until people have had such a bad time and have shaken themselves out of it will they be able to straighten up and take the upward swing of the pendulum which, in the course of time, will lead to the golden age. I've got a PS here. And it reads, can you please explain the relationship and or difference of hypnosis to meditation, and is hypnosis a worthwhile endeavor for overcoming bad habits or problems? Actually, there is no relationship at all between meditation and hypnosis. In meditation, one is completely under one's own control, able to send one's intellect soaring out to other dimensions. Mind you, I'm talking about meditation. None of that cult nonsense for which one pays a lot of money and gets nothing in return. It is my firm belief that the only meditation worthwhile is that which is done alone, because just think of people, everyone has an aura, and the aura can extend quite away from the body. So if you get a whole bunch of people together, then you get auras jamming the meditation processes of others. In my opinion, you cannot truly, or satisfactorily, meditate in a group. In hypnosis, one surrenders control to oneself to another person, and I maintain it weakens one's self-control. After all, you want to be you, don't you? You don't want to be mixed up with, let us say, Bill Dogsbody. You know what your name is, you know what you are, you know what you would like to be. You like your own privacy. And so why should you possibly want to get hypnotized, which is a process under which you surrender part of your privacy to another person? No, I am against hypnotism, dead against it. It is such a harmful thing. You get, for example, a stage hypnotist who says that he will cure a certain person of a certain complaint. Well, he doesn't do that. If he is a hypnotist, he can, undoubtedly, influence the person to hide or disguise the symptoms of the illness, and then if the symptoms are disguised, how can one expect that even the most intelligent doctor will find out that from which the person suffers? By the time the victim has been hypnotized for a certain period, then the illness usually is quite incurable. So my strong advice is, never allow yourself to be hypnotized unless it is by a fully qualified medical practitioner who has also been trained in hypnotic practices and techniques. As a doctor, he will have taken note of your symptoms. As a hypnotist, he will know how to channel those symptoms into any worthwhile path possible. Remember that a doctor takes an oath to give one relief from pain and to do no evil. Well, our friend Mr. John Bigras and the two Bigras cats have gone roaring off to Banff and on to Vancouver. I have been out twice since coming from hospital, two little visits to the outskirts of the city, two little trips when I could look out over the city from the foothills leading to the Rockies. Now, I suppose, once again I am a shut-in, stuck here mainly in one room in a bed or in a wheelchair. Cars are very useful things, but I do not have one. Anyway, they are far too expensive on an author's income, as I told the income tax people when they tried to deny me an income tax allowance on the purchase of an electric wheelchair. Well, one doesn't have a wheelchair for pleasure but only because it is essential. I told them that with my disabilities I should really be on welfare, instead of that I work at writing books to make myself independent of welfare. But instead of the income tax people giving me any concessions, they try to deduct the last penny they can. For instance, I paid my income tax and then from one department I got a note saying that my income tax was all clear. The very next day I got another note from another department saying I had to pay a fine because I paid my tax once a year instead of every 3 to 6 months. So people who work as bricklayers or navvies or cab drivers or anything like that are far better off tax-wise than I am because the income tax people soak me the limit and beyond, and I often wonder at the mentality and personality of these people who can be income tax collectors and batten on the troubles of disabled people. However, that is not answering questions, is it? And that is what this book is supposed to be. So let's get on with the unending pile of questions. They grow, you know, I have enough questions here for 10 or 20 books, and yesterday I had a whole bunch of quite abstract metaphysical questions sent on from Brazil. Is it important enough for the inhabitants of this plane to know more of the other planes of existence beyond the astral? If so, could you elucidate on them? Perhaps give us at least a sketchy idea of the structure of the planes of existence? Also, what happens when a spirit evolves to the plane below that of the highest, or that of God? Can a spirit actually evolve to the highest plane, or is that too preposterous to even discuss? Well, it is only possible to discuss the plane above, the astral, and it is much like this world although it has another dimension. Time, for instance, is not at all the same as it is on this world. Travel is different, too, if you want to get to a place you think yourself there. You might be sitting down looking out across the landscape and feel that you would like to call on a friend who might be a certain distance away. Well, if you think of the friend, and think of his location, then almost imperceptibly you will find yourself there with your friend. Nor will you find, in the astral world, prudishness or pornography. When you get to the astral world you find to your considerable astonishment at first that you are as bare as a peeled banana and you have quite literally to think up any form of clothing which takes your fancy. But after a time, well, you find that these things do not matter. The things of the spirit count more, and that is not as a pun either. In the astral plane you cannot meet people with whom you are antagonistic. And of course the higher you go the more compatible you are with the people around you. Now, you can usually get up to about the ninth plane of existence and then you no longer find that the over-self is sending out puppets. Instead there is only one extension from the over-self, after the ninth plane. Of course there are a vast number of planes of existence, and you go on and on getting more and more dimensions, but there would be no point in trying to discuss some of these other dimensions unless you have been there because there is no point of reference. How would you, for example, discuss atomic theory with an ant who was more interested in getting on with the ordinary business of day-to-day living? How could you discuss nuclear thermoelectrics with a bee who was far more interested in going out and collecting pollen, or whatever they collect, so that the process of making honey could continue? No. Until you have had experience of other dimensions, you are not able to discuss them. It's like having a year-old baby trying to discuss brain surgery with one of our leading surgeons. But there is no limit to how high you can go. Remember the old saying that there is always plenty of room at the top of the ladder. And, you see, God is not an old gent with a beard and a shepherd's crook who comes along and hooks in all the wayward lambs. God is a different thing altogether, nothing that you can understand down here. Here your nearest conception of a god is Imanu, that is, one of the branch managers who looks after this particular departmental store which we call Earth. Under him he has a lot of assistant managers who look after continents, lands, and cities. They seem to have made a pretty poor show of it of late, don't they?